We have a full program today. Look forward to being joined later this hour by our good friend Mike Barnett. The Cleveland Indians are in Kansas City. They have an 8 o'clock first pitch, so he'll join us in this first hour to talk about essentially the first month of the Major League Baseball season. We also look forward to being joined, Jimmy, by VFL Corte Sapp. Really look forward to that conversation, which will start hour number two.
Yeah, Corte played for Tennessee and in football. He had a couple of opportunities with the Titans and came very close to making that team. But we're going to talk to him about his football career. We're also going to talk to him about adjusting to life after football and some of the things that he did not know in dealing with. So we'll talk to him about that and how football players need to be prepared, not just football, but college athletes need to be prepared for life after college. And we'll discuss that with Corte.
We also look forward to being joined by John McClain of the Houston Chronicle, as it's our first visit with him since the NFL draft. We'll catch up with our old friend Chris Monter of College Beat Basketball News, as well as Monter Draft News. We'll talk about the NBA with him. And we look forward to bringing your chance to win with a Sports Fix at 6. All that, and as well as plenty of other comments coming your way today on Sports Talk.
We'll get to our news and notes brought to you by Image Matters, technology you need, people that you can trust. Tennessee Sports Writers Association has selected their Women's Basketball Player of the Year, Raniyah Davis of Tennessee. She averaged 17.3 points, 8.8 rebounds, shot 48% from the field, 85.3% from the foul line. So Raniyah Davis is the Tennessee Sports Writers Tennessee State Women's Basketball Player of the Year. Coach of the Year, Belmont's Bart Brooks, led the team to a 21-6 record, a sixth consecutive 20-win season. They won the conference tournament for the fifth time in 6 years, and they scored a first-round NCAA tournament victory over Gonzaga, which was ranked number 13 in the country. So a big win for Belmont. So those are the two honorees. Tennessee, 81 student-athletes graduating, and for the first time, their ceremonies will be at Neyland Stadium. Nine of these student-athletes will be getting their master's, and a couple of them taking advantage of the RAC program. That's a renewed academic program that they have. Bobby Mays, basketball, Julio Borbón, baseball. Those are the two that are getting their degree from the RAC program. Tennessee started this many, many years ago, and basically it was this. If you were an athlete at Tennessee and you didn't get your degree and you want to come back later and get your degree, Tennessee paid for it. And they were on the cutting edge of that. They may have been one of the first in the SEC to do that, and they have continued that. But as far as the out of the 81, 12 in swimming and diving, 8 in baseball, 11 in football, 11 in track and field. Those are the most sports represented by those getting their degree. Tennessee, with their final ratings for basketball, and wow, when you look at it, it's like every one of them improved. Kennedy Chandler went from the number 2 point guard to the number 1 point guard, and he went from being ranked number 17 prospect in the country to number 8. The 7-foot center, Jonas Adu, went from being ranked 80th to 38th. He's the number 6 rated center in the country. Brandon Hundley Hatfield went from number 22 to number 20. He's the number 7 rated power forward in the country. And Jamal Mashick went from 56 to 51. The number 10 shooting, or I'm sorry, number 10 small forward in the class. So that's a look at the ratings of four of the five Tennessee signees. I am surprised by this, and I don't mean to be insulting here, but Tennessee offensive lineman Cade Mays, who I did not think had a great year last year, has been projected as a first-round pick by 6 different draft mocks for next year. CBS Sports has him going number 16 in the first round, Yahoo Sports number 13, Pro Football Network 22, Fox 23, Sporting News 32, the number 5 offensive lineman, College Football News number 11. Good for him. Now, that means he's going to have a big year this year to put himself in that position. Again, I don't think he had the year that he would have wanted this past season. We'll see if we can up his stock and play better this upcoming season at Tennessee. As far as the NFL draft, at Cleveland, 160,000 fans attended over the 3 days. Now, I was reading an article in USA Today. 10 of the biggest steals of the NFL draft, well, almost half of them were from the SEC. In fact, 40% were. The Jets getting wide receiver Elijah Moore from Ole Miss in the second round. The Patriots getting defensive tackle Christian Barmore from Alabama in the second round. The Giants getting linebacker Azeez Ojulari from Georgia, who's a terrific pass rusher, late in the second round. And then the Panthers getting LSU receiver Terrence Marshall late in the second round. Those were four of the 10 biggest steals of the NFL draft, very much centered around SEC players. I thought that was pretty interesting. And, John, the Ice Bears, they start the playoffs. They will be hosting Pensacola. That'll be at 7:35. And then Friday they will go to Pensacola. The Ice Bears 5-3 against the Ice Flyers this season. So playoff hockey for the Ice Bears, which is pretty typical. They seem to make the playoffs pretty much every year.
Yeah, I believe it's 17 straight trips to the playoffs. And as you mentioned, they won the season series against Pensacola. Ice Flyers won the most recent meetings, which was back-to-back at their place. So the all-important game one, best of three. It would be Sunday back in Knoxville if necessary. But puck drops tonight at 7:35, and we wish them the very, very best.
Another NFL note I meant to mention, Ryan Wilson with CBS, Green Bay, the favorite pick, his favorite pick from Green Bay, Amari Rodgers, product of Catholic High School, played at Clemson, son of T. Martin. Kansas City, best value, offensive lineman, Trey Smith. Chargers, most surprising pick, Josh Palmer, third round wide receiver. And also sticking with the NFL, who knows about how this report that I read. Aaron Rodgers referred to the general manager, Brian Gutekunst, at Green Bay as the Jerry Krause of the franchise. Now, most people give Krause a bad rap because of he kind of blew up the Chicago Bulls on their run that looked like they could have had a chance to win another NBA title, but he decided it was time to rebuild, and so he did. And I did see where Mike DeCourcy was saying what he needs to do is history on that because he thought Krause was a good GM. I think most people look at it as Krause blowing up the Bulls when they had a chance to win another one. Also, Brett Favre said that he thinks this gut feeling is that Aaron Rodgers is done with Green Bay. I think most people feel that's the situation. And there was an Aaron Rodgers commercial that ran on a video board at a minor league baseball game in Wisconsin, and there was a smattering of boos. I guess they feel like the inevitable, he's leaving. Reportedly, Aaron Rodgers told some free agent candidates that he would not be in Green Bay in 2021. And also of note, he hosted Jeopardy for 2 weeks. The week after he hosted Jeopardy, the ratings declined 7% with Anderson Cooper as the guest host. It also went from a number one rating, in game shows, to number three behind Wheel of Fortune and Family Feud. Anyway, that's, enough on Aaron Rodgers. All right, a couple of other notes. I picked my Lindy's All-SEC team, and it's a daunting task because you go three deep. And, look, it's really hard to find five offensive linemen on your third string and same for the secondary and others. John, I really had trouble finding Tennessee players to put on that list. I didn't end up being very kind to the Vols because I just didn't see that many players that I thought that I could justify putting on all-SEC team, first, second, or third team. Now, some positions are loaded. Linebacker is loaded. Mm-hmm. It's really pretty darn good in the secondary, too. The place where you don't have that much is defensive line. But having said all that, I only had three Tennessee players on the team. I had Cade Mays' second team, and that's based off what he did last year. Uh-huh. I had Paxton Brooks as the third-team punter. He has the third-best punting average returning from last year. And I went all-purpose Velus Jones Jr. Those are the three Vols. I considered others, but I just couldn't pull the trigger on anybody else that I thought was more deserving of the people that I had on there. So that's a bit of a challenge for Tennessee and Josh Heupel and this staff, given what I think is just a shortage of talent in reference to the rest of the SEC. So they could very well prove me wrong, but that's kind of the way I saw it in trying to pick my all-SEC team. All right, Knoxville Catholic, they're going to play Norcross in boys basketball in the Peach Ball Classic. That'll be in Atlanta, January the 17th. And this was a note I thought was kind of interesting. So, and I actually think it was a little bit inaccurate. But anyway, I saw a note that the average RPI of the 14 SEC softball teams is 17.23. Well, there are only 13 SEC teams in softball, right? Vanderbilt
yes,
in softball.
That is correct.
So I saw that note, and I thought, okay, well, that might change the average a little bit. But that's pretty impressive when your average RPI, even though it might be slightly off, is around 17. The best ever for the SEC in terms of a on RPI. In 2018, 15.69. But that just, again, shows you how tough the SEC is in not just softball, but they're good in so darn many sports. It's kind of almost ridiculous. And also, so I was watching some of the Yankees game against the Astros last night. It's the first time the Astros have played against the Yankees since the cheating scandal. And, yeah, the Astros cheated, but they weren't the only one. There were implications against other franchises, Boston being one, the Yankees being another. And so I don't know what all they found out with the Yankees, but I just wasn't so sure the Yankees should have gone to the extent they did in razzing the Astros, because the Yankees were guilty of sign stealing as well. They didn't do it with a trash can. I mean, that's kind of like Elizabeth Taylor criticizing people for getting a divorce. I mean, the Yankees, what are they doing out there? You know, okay, but and I know the Astros shouldn't have done what they did. I get all that, but still, I'm thinking the Yankees aren't exactly the main ones that should be carrying that torch given what they did. So.
Well said, yeah, because the whole Apple Watch business, that came from the Bronx.
Yes, exactly.
That came from the Bronx.
Yep.
And so they influenced it. Now, it might be like, say, some restaurants and how they feel they handled it. We didn't invent the chicken sandwich. We perfected it. There were other teams that improved upon the process, but the Yankees were the first to have technology involved sign stealing.
Yep.
Period. End of story.
I know the Astros shouldn't have done what they did, but I will say this. They won Game 7 of the World Series in Los Angeles, and they won two of those World Series games in Los Angeles without the trash cans. So they were pretty darn good without them, and I wish they hadn't used them because I think they could have won it anyway. But anyway, I just thought it was kind of hypocritical of the Yankee fans to be as boisterous as they were. And nobody brought it up. I'm watching ESPN. Nobody brought up about the Yankees. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Didn't say a word about it. But I remembered. One other quick note, NFL Jaguars. They have fired four staffers in the scouting and personnel department that had a combined 66 years of experience with the Jaguars. So Urban Meyer gets rid of four that have been around forever, tried to hire a strength and conditioning coach that blew up in his face. I guess the best thing he's done so far is draft Trevor Lawrence.
Yes. So did that well.
Yeah. I could have helped him with that one.
That's right. Filled out the card, handed it in on time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But it's going to be interesting to see with Urban Meyer running the show down there in Jacksonville. So anyway, those are our news and notes brought to you by Image Matters.
That's Jimmy Himes. I'm John Wilkerson. Just want to say, one, congratulations to all of the UT student-athletes that are graduating. It's impressive to know exactly what they have to do just to be ready for their sport and then also get the work done on their degree. Did want to highlight baseball. As you mentioned, Jimmy, eight are graduating. You've got one in Julio Borbón from the 05 College World Series team. He was a freshman on that squad. You've got two that got their master's degree, Will Heflin and Pete Durkay, and you have another five, including a member of the junior college ranks, that earned their degree. So that's just one example of the incredible work that is done academically. And, of course, all of this was done after everything shut down for not just them, but all the spring sports last March. So tip of the cap, can't say how impressed I am with the Vols and Lady Vols and the fact that they have stayed on track and been able to do so well as they have in the classroom.
Yep, well said.
That's Jimmy Himes. I'm John Wilkerson. Sports Talk continues. We're here at Cineholic today. Cineholic Gourmet Cinnamon Rolls, 9450 South North Shore, Suite 106. It's right where near North Shore meets up with Pellissippi. They've got you taken care of for Mother's Day, and they also have another location if that's the one that's closest to you, 2655 Teaster Lane in Pigeon Forge, Unit 220. So, again, they have the Mother's Day box. It's best if you pre-order, because then they'll have the order and you'll know that you're taken care of. We'll give you the phone numbers. We got it all going on today at Cineholic Gourmet Cinnamon Rolls.
John, one quick note, and I want to get your take on this. L.A. Dodgers, 4-12 in their last 16 games. Is that a blip on the radar, or is 16 games enough to make you wonder if the Dodgers are that good?
I'll say this. I don't think it's a hangover because they got off to a great, great start. But I would be concerned for the fact that you do have Clayton Kershaw coming off his shortest outing in terms of non-injury related. So there are some things that I think to be concerned about. And you just it is just so difficult to repeat. So I just think that, I would be concerned. I do think, obviously, there's a ton of baseball left, but and they do have the money, and they also have everything else in terms of great talent. But, yeah, I'd be a little concerned because all of a sudden they're not first and they're not close.
No, and then the thing about them is I still think they're good enough to reel off 10 wins in 12 games to flip that switch. So I think they're good enough to do that. They just hit a bad patch right now, but a 16-game stretch like that does give you a little bit of cause for concern.
It does, and so I do think that they in the end they'll likely be fine, but you just never know. It's always different the next year. Even if, like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Jimmy, return everybody, it's just different when you're coming off a championship as opposed to a team that's trying to clear that last hurdle.
You're right about that, and you know sometimes I think when you're coming off a championship, it's probably good to bring in some new blood because that person didn't experience it. So right. They're not going to be complacent at all. They're going to like, well, I want my ring too. So I think sometimes it's great if you return all of them, but I think sometimes it doesn't hurt you if you have a little bit of a different makeup, a little bit different roster situation just for some people that might be more hungry than you.
Yeah, I think that's an outstanding point because you do need that drive. And for those that just completed the journey, sure, they're motivated. They want to win a championship, but it's not near as fever pitch as it was the year before. But we will talk about the Dodgers. We will talk about that and all under the umbrella that is Major League Baseball when we look forward to catching up with our good friend Mike Barnett as he joins us next on Sports Talk today at Cineholic Gourmet Cinnamon Rolls. We're at the North Shore location, which is right here, 9450 South North Shore, Suite 106, right near where it intersects with Pellissippi. It's always a pleasure to say hello to our longtime friend. He's video coordinator for the Cleveland Indians, Mike Barnett. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good, John. Jimmy, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
So when you get when you get to a town like Kansas City that you've been to 100 times, if not more, is there any place that you feel you have to go, or is it kind of lay of the land right now? You just kind of hang out at the hotel still?
No, we're still kind of hanging out at the hotel. We're really not. I mean, we can go out and walk around the Plaza area, which is really nice here in Kansas City, but really not allowed to go out to any restaurants unless it's to outdoor dining, and they have food for us at the hotel, so it's pretty much just business as usual every day. You know, go to the hotel, get up, go grab something to eat down in one of the ballrooms, and then head to the ballpark and get ready for another game.
Well, for Cleveland, how would you rate and grade the first month of the season?
Well, I tell you what, it's been interesting. We've got our ups and downs, I think, like every club has in Major League Baseball. And, you know, we really haven't, our pitching's been pretty good, and our fourth and fifth starters have struggled a little bit. Our bullpen has been outstanding. And kind of the surprising thing, offensively, we're finding a way to score some runs, and it's mainly been via the home run ball. I think right now we're scoring 52% of our runs via the home run, which is something that we probably didn't quite expect coming into the year. But to this point, it's been pretty good. It's been enjoyable. It's been a lot of fun. And, you know, it's been a great group. They've got a lot of great energy and things like the intangibles that you love to see. And we're just going out battling every day. And it's fun to be, just a game out of first place and playing Kansas City, who's in first right now, tied with the White Sox. So hopefully have a good night tonight with Bieber on the mound and keep it rolling.
Mike, I thought I knew baseball rules, and then I saw something yesterday, and I want you to help me out on this if you can. So you're playing Kansas City, and KC's got runners on base. They hit a long fly ball to right center field. You know where I'm going with this, right?
Right.
Yeah,
yep,
so they hit a long fly ball to right center field. It's not caught, and there's confusion about whether it was or wasn't caught. Andrew Benintendi with Kansas City, round second base. He's not sure what to do. He gets tagged out. Then after discussion, he is allowed to go to third base. Can you explain to me what happened?
Well, you know, it was a fly ball deep to right center. Runners, I believe it was first and second or second, third. I can't quite remember the situation where the runners were except for Benintendi. But none of the umpires made a call on the field. Now, Angel Hernandez says that he did, and it wasn't very evident that he did, that he had called the fly ball a catch. And so in doing that, the confusion with Benintendi, they awarded him third base. But to me, he really didn't make a call. He was the first base umpire and barely got out to the grass, and the ball's deep in right center field. And you barely kind of see his arm as the throw's coming back in, kind of hold his right fist up like it was an out. So, you know, everybody on the field was confused. I personally think that the play should have been where, you know, because of the confusion, everything like that, the ball wasn't caught, that Benintendi should have been, you know, called out when we tagged him out. But thank goodness it didn't hurt us. You know, the umpires got together and, you know, they basically screwed up the call and they knew it. And they did that what they thought was best, which they have the right to do, to place runners where they think they should be. And, you know, it's just something's got to happen there a little bit sooner where there's got to be a catch or no-catch call made by somebody. And the closest guy to it was the second-base umpire, but he was in the middle of the infield, and he made no call. None of the umpires that we saw made a call.
Do you think that play deserved review?
You know, I think it probably does, but I think the thing that would come out would be the same thing. Because the fact is that you really can't, all the angles didn't cover, but nobody on the field, nothing we saw in video, saw any of the umpires make a call. But I think if you did, because of the confusion, they would have gone and done the same thing. They would have put Benintendi at third. So I think that would be the way to get it right and say there's confusion. But, you know, my point on it is it was at twilight, which is always a tough time to pick up the ball in the air. And if you have an outfielder that, you know, all of a sudden doesn't see the fly ball and he misses it, and you go, well, wait a minute, because it was twilight, but you should give us an out there because that was a routine fly ball. And I don't know where. It's just one of those quirky plays that happens in the game from time to time. But I would have, you know, liked to have seen the umpires get out a little bit more and try to make a definitive call, and I think they kind of assumed it was going to be caught, and it wasn't.
I want to ask you about Francisco Lindor. He was terrific for so many years with Cleveland. Now with the Mets, he's hitting 163, no home runs, 3 RBI. He was in an 0-for-20 slump. Do you think that he is yielding to the pressure of a $341 million contract, or do you think something else is at work as to why he is struggling at the plate?
Well, I think probably, you know, it's probably where it's something to do mechanical or, you know, not getting started on time, which I would think would be the biggest thing that we've seen here, where he's not getting to the point where he's getting started enough soon enough to pick up the baseball to put good swings on it. And we've seen, you know, Frankie struggle from time to time here, but usually not this bad, but you know, it usually happens in the middle of the year when guys go through one of their little funks, but it's really magnified because, you know, if he hit a stretch like this in the middle of the year and everybody else is hitting, nobody makes a big deal of it. But now you just signed a $340 million contract. You're playing in New York. It's to open the season. I think it's there's a lot of pressure on him to perform there, and I think that is probably the biggest reason why he's had his struggles early on. And, you know, unfortunately, Chili Davis you know, their assistant hitting coach were fired. And that's going to even add more pressure, you know, to Frankie. But he's a great talent. And I really, truly expect that, you know, he'll bounce back and, you know, put up the numbers that you normally expect. And too many times early in the year, you know, numbers good or bad are magnified so much. But when you have guys with track records, everybody will have a way up year and then a little bit of a down year. But usually you can count on what's on the back of their bubblegum card to be there, you know, by the time we get to October 3rd.
Mike, I would imagine that any time a team decides to make a move with their hitting instructor and coach, that hits close to home with you.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it happens. And, you know, us here, Ty Van Berkelio, and we've talked about it, and Victor Rodriguez, the assistant hitting coach, and Justin Toole, I've been there. I got, had a couple good years in Toronto and then got fired 20 games into the season in Toronto in 2005. And, you know, fortunately it worked out good. I went over to to your Red Sox, which was just a tremendous, so much fun to be part of that organization for a little while. So it happens, and, you know, you're not going to fire the players, the old adage, and, you know, you're going to get rid of the coaches to try to shake some things up. And it's just something that you, especially at this level, you just kind of really understand that it goes with the territory, and, you know, sometimes it's out of your control. It's just a bad stretch, and you got caught up in it, and you're in a big media market, and you end up getting fired. And I feel bad for Chile, but you know, because he's a great hitting coach, and I think he's more of an old-school hitting coach, which makes it a little bit tougher as well, because he's not so doesn't adhere so much to the analytics and swing up on the baseball, and I think that probably adds to him getting, you know, fired so quickly.
Just a quick word on that. What do you think in terms of how the game has moved? It has become such an all-or-nothing mentality in the batter's box. You do see a great number of home runs. You do see a lot of power on display, but you also see team batting averages just plummeting. And for somebody who has spent the better part of his baseball life talking about the best way to make contact and hit and things like that, what do you think in terms of this trend? Is there anything that would move us back towards the middle of people looking for contact and trying to get on opposed to the four-base swing?
Well, I think it's starting to slowly. People are starting to realize it, because I just saw a stat the other day that said that the month of April was the one of the worst 2 months ever in the history of Major League Baseball as far as offensive numbers, especially as far as batting average and, you know, team scoring runs. And, you know, you just don't see, you know, guys moving runners, hitting runs anymore, people being able to sacrifice bunt except for pitchers in the National League. And, you know, I think that when you have opportunities like that, because of the strength of bullpens, especially against starters, you got to do some of those things to put runs on the board and get a lead. I mean, that is so big, because if you can get a lead in the sixth inning, a lot of these bullpens are just shut down, and it kind of evidenced with our club. And if we get a lead, you know, in the sixth, we feel pretty good, especially if we can put, you know, Shaw and Karinchak and Emmanuel Clase out there to finish it up. It makes a big, big difference. And one of the clubs that is kind of interesting we're playing now is kind of a little bit of a throwback. Kansas City is playing a lot of the small ball. You know, they can slug and drive the ball to the gap and hit the ball out of the ballpark. But, you know, last night they hit and run twice with Benintendi and Lopez against a left-hand pitcher. They'll use the bunt for a base hit. They've used the safety squeeze. They've used the suicide squeeze. So it's good to see a club doing some of those things, and, you know, people are recognizing that. So I'm hoping that eventually it's going to come back, that guys starting to have to flatten their swings out a little bit, use the whole field. And, you know, we talk about it all the time that, you know, it's become such a launch pull mentality. And if you look at our game success, when our guys are driving the ball middle of the field the other way, that's usually when we put up a lot of runs. And, you know, I think eventually people are going to start realizing that home runs are great, but you know what? If you want to sustain an offense and you got to find a way to get a lead, sometimes you've got to do some things early in the game to make that happen.
A couple of quick rule change questions. Bigger bases, 15 inches to 18 square inches in AAA. What's the thinking behind that? Why would you have bigger bases?
They've talked about it as far as a safety issue. You know, so the guys aren't jamming their foot. They've got more area to hit their foot on. And I think it is a way to really just cause more offense in the game. I think, you know, they've made a lot of these changes, and they're looking at it, and they pitching has been so dominant that they're trying to find ways to get more offense into the game. And whereas I think it's more, you want to get offense back into the game, let's talk about approach and doing some of those little things. And they've even talked about, you know, moving the mound back an extra foot in the Atlantic League, which, this is such a great game. And I think Abner Doubleday had it right when he put the bases 90 feet apart and, you know, the pitching mound 60 feet, 6 inches away. And I would just hate to see that stuff go by the wayside to where in another 15 or 20 years, we don't even recognize the game of baseball, how it's been for 150, 200 years.
One other one, in Double A, they're going to limit shifts. Do you think they should limit shifts in the majors?
Not really, because as much as I hate the shift, I don't think you're allowed, you should be allowed to tell a club, where you can play guys. And, I see it routinely night in and night out, that would definitely bring more offense to the game, and especially for left-hand hitters. But routinely I see clubs in the shift and routine ground balls to shortstop and second base that normally would be outs end up being base hits and going through. So I really don't, where that is going to benefit hitters, especially left-hand hitters, I just don't think it's right that you're going to dictate that you can only, use so many shifts or limited shifts. I just don't think it's right for the game.
Mike, always appreciate your time. I know you can't wait to get to the ballpark any day, but it's got to be a lot of fun when you've got the reigning Cy Young Award winner going for your guys. I think he's picked up where he left off, even though the record might not overwhelm you right now. His stuff is outstanding. You would put Bieber in that conversation. Just a quick answer. Who else would be some of the other top pitchers in the game right now that you can't wait to see video of?
Well, you look at what DeGrom's done, but he's gone on the DL right now. And, we faced Garrett Cole last week, and gee, many Christmas. He's tremendous as well. Cole and Bieber are two completely different types of guys, but they both find ways to strike you out. And Bieber does it more, old school, pitching. And because his numbers aren't going to pop your eyes out on the radar gun, but this guy can spin a breaking ball, a curveball, and a slider. He can locate his baseball. It is a joy to come to the ballpark every night he's pitching. And, I just marvel every night that he comes out. But there's a lot of good pitchers out there, and it's going to be fun, too, to see the development of some of those guys with the White Sox, too. The Michael Kopech, we've seen him out of the bullpen twice, and once he moves into the rotation, he's going to be something else. This kid's throwing 96, 97 miles an hour with a nasty slider. So there's a lot of fun talent that's coming up. And, we saw a kid here that made his debut the other night, Daniel Lynch for the Royals, as a starter, 6'6", throwing 96, 97 with a hard slider, good changeup, and throw strikes. So I think the pitching in this game is really it's a plus right now. Now we just need to get the hitting back to where it balances it out, and you're going to have a little bit more exciting baseball. Because anymore now, guys throwing 96, 97, players are not afraid of velocity anymore because they see it night in and night out. But for me, the biggest thing to get this game back to where it's really enjoyable and enjoying the whole talent of the game is get the hitting approach back to where we're using more of the whole field and more situational hitting. I think stealing bases as well. I think that's going to, bring the excitement back to the game rather than, glorified home run derby night in, night out.
Good luck to the Tribe tonight as they look for a fourth straight win and perhaps a share of first place, but always appreciate your time. Safe travels, and we look forward to talking to you again very soon, Mike.
John, Jimmy, thanks. Great, and go Vols. I love to see what they're doing, and they haven't lost except one series in the SEC. I believe that's right this year, and I'm excited to see that. It's great, and go Vols. Keep it going, Tony.
All right. Sure do appreciate that, Mike. Mike Barnett, video coordinator for the Cleveland Indians, joining us on the Stanley Fencing and Gates Hotline. And, Jimmy, we have another very special guest that will join us next.
Look forward to Corte Sapp joining us. He played for Tennessee. He was there for most under Jeremy Pruitt for a while, and he's been out in the workforce now. And he also came very close to making it with the Titans. I want to talk to him about his Tennessee career and his life after football.
That's coming up next to start hour number two of Sports Talk, which today is at Cineholic Gourmet Cinnamon Rolls, South North Shore, right around the Pellissippi Parkway, Suite 106. Come find us. They'll get you taken care of for Mother's Day with their Mother's Day box. They also have a number of other fantastic treats just waiting on you right here. There's here in Knoxville and also in Pigeon Forge on Teaster Lane. Cineholic Gourmet Cinnamon Rolls. Hour number two of Sports Talk is next on 99.1 The Sports Animal.